SER 107.3.
That the community has a right to be informed, and that the community has the right to fight for what it loves.
An offence which has been on the rise and has cost Australians up to $1 billion.
Most people sort of fantasise about flying. Most people think about it. But rather than just thinking about it, we do it.
I've been stopped on the street and spat on.
How many pages do I have to do and how much have I done so far? I've only done like 1%.
And bang, within like a split second, I had no time to react, I was on the ground.
Because the reason why this is even occurring is because there's a demand.
Good evening and welcome to Razor's Edge for the second Thursday of May. I'm Jesse Begley and this is Razor's Edge, Sydney's own New South Wales-focused current affairs program. This week, we have four stories covering the most relevant and upcoming news made for the local audience of Sydney and New South Wales. From Bondi to Blackstown, Hornsby to Sutherland, our producers are out and about covering stories from your local area. This week, we look at the reasons couples and single women are looking to IVF for assisted pregnancies. We look at the government's proposal to drug test welfare recipients. And from the 15th to the 19th of May, it's National Law Week. We speak to Legal Aid New South Wales, who during this week are setting up in New South Wales libraries to help offer tips and insights on navigating cybersecurity for older people. Also, we look at how highly closing the gap between Indigenous and non-Indigenous Australians was prioritised this year in this year's federal budget. But now let's go to our first story. Couples and single women are looking to IVF for assisted pregnancies. And with the practices within Australia, we can understand the reasons for standardising IVF programs for a safer and low-risk delivery. Razor's Edge producer Hyo Jin Shim chats with Dr. Sonal Kharia from Jinia to get the lowdown.
Well, there are a variety of reasons that women choose the IVF option. And quite often there can be an absolute reason as to why a woman is unable to conceive naturally. A couple of examples of that would be if, say, a woman has got very badly damaged fallopian tubes, or say her fallopian tubes have been removed in the past through surgery. There is practically no other way for her to conceive on her own except to get assistance with IVF. Equally, sometimes there could be a reason on the side of the male partner where the sperm quality or the sperm number can be extremely poor. One very important thing I would like to tell your listeners is people are having IVF even to try and reduce the risk of having a baby with genetic abnormalities in future, because through IVF technology, we can actually screen embryos before a woman becomes pregnant and reduce their risk of passing on a genetic abnormality to the next generation. Yes, there can be other reasons. So sometimes it can be just purely a problem of the sperm and the egg getting together. Say, for example, sexual dysfunction, which people don't tend to talk a lot about because there is a stigma associated with it, is a common reason for presentation for couples to our rooms and to our clinics, because quite often they find it difficult to have natural intercourse. And sometimes they're having fertility treatment not because there is an actual fertility issue, but they can't get the sperm and the egg together. Of course, we shouldn't forget that single women are trying to have babies with donor sperm. There are women who may be in same-sex relationship or men in same-sex relationships who may want to have children. And all these people are now availing of fertility treatment. It's very important for our listeners to know that women are actually born with a fixed number of eggs, and we don't make new eggs during our lifetime. Naturally, our eggs tend to get released, the best ones tend to get released in the most fertile years of our lifetime, which is somewhere between the age of 20 and 36, 37 years of age. It's a different scenario for people who are using donor eggs from younger women. So personally, I do think that, yes, we overall still have a reasonably healthy birth rate. A part of the decline in the birth rate is obviously the reflection that women are tending to delay conception to their older years. So a healthy lifestyle, not smoking, reducing the amount of alcohol intake, having a reasonably healthy and nutritious diet and daily exercise are all a part of a consultation for fertility workup.
We've noticed that some candidates go offshore to America to look at some surrogacy programs and even to be able to pick the gender of the embryo?
There are very strict guidelines in Australia in terms of gender selection and surrogacy. And that's obviously with a very good intent of protecting the gender balance as well as trying to protect the rights of women and not for them to get exploited at the end of the day. Gender selection, selectively for medical reasons, can be permitted after a lot of counseling and consent from the individuals and from the unit that they're going through treatment. But you're right that people do seek services overseas where gender selection is actually legal and allowed just for family balancing and for social reasons. Coming down to surrogacy, commercial surrogacy is not permitted in Australia, but Australia does allow altruistic surrogacy where the woman is doing it out of the goodwill of her heart just to assist another woman or another couple to fulfill their dream of having a baby.
We found that IVF has also become an option for their next few children.
Yes, it is an option for their next few children, and especially if the circumstances have changed. So after the first couple of pregnancies, for example, if a woman has landed up having some ectopic pregnancies where her tubes are damaged or removed, or there has been a health-related issue in the male partner, admittedly, the opposite is also true, that sometimes couples go through IVF for their first or second pregnancy and then have a natural pregnancy of their own. Well, if the one thing that I can pass on through media today to the community is that there is this big myth that IVF is a solution to every fertility problem. Like I have emphasized earlier, that female age is one factor that nobody can change. And although quite often I hear my patients saying, "The doctor, I feel much younger," I have to keep emphasizing to them that your ovary does know your age. And you cannot escape that natural process of deterioration in the egg quality and the egg number as age advances. So it would be good for women to start considering reproduction in the most reproductive years of their life, which is somewhere between 20 and 37 years of age.
We could look at some of the options for preserving eggs for the future.
So we see a lot of women presenting to us to have their fertility frozen, which primarily can be done in the form of freezing their eggs or freezing a part of their ovary and then utilizing it at a later date. Now, as good as this option sounds and as fascinating as it is an option which is almost like a backup, but it may or may not work in the future, and it's certainly not a guarantee that if you freeze your eggs when you're younger, then it's definitely going to give you a baby in future. So although it's not legally binding, guidelines are very, very strict in Australia. And again, it's to protect the health of our women. The one other thing that I would like to mention is fertility preservation is a very, very good option for women who are going through treatment, or even for men who are going through treatment which is likely to affect their fertility, like a chemotherapy situation for cancer patients. And those patients definitely need to be encouraged to preserve their fertility so that they can still have a family of their own once their cancer treatment is completed.
Thank you to Dr. Sonal Kariya from Genea Fertility, from the Genea Fertility Specialists. Don't go anywhere. After this break, we're looking at the government's proposal to drug test welfare recipients. You're on Razor's Edge, 2SER 107.3.
Injured in an accident can have a real impact on you financially. Injuries can mean time off work, medical bills and other expenses. But you might actually be entitled to compensation to cover these expenses. If you're unsure, call a specialist injury lawyer and ask. Law Partners is Australia's largest specialist personal injury firm, and it costs nothing to call their local office to get some advice. Call Law Partners on 133529 or visit lawpartners.com.au.
2SER sponsors.
Now, this Monday, the budget was released, and the government put forward a proposal to include a drug test for welfare recipients. Prime Minister Malcolm Turnbull said of the proposal to drug test that it will be doing them a favour. The proposal has been met with criticism by many from the welfare sector. And this is Adrian Walton from 2SER speaking with Michael Moore, Chief Executive Officer of the Public Health Association of Australia.
Why do you think the government has proposed these drug tests for welfare recipients?
Oh, I think this is a little bit of an appeal to the right wing of the party. The budget has been very, very interesting. As Annabelle Crabb points out, what Malcolm Turnbull is doing is cleaning up the mess of his predecessors who were running these very, very conservative budgets, who were attacking Medicare, attacking pretty well anybody who wasn't an ultra-conservative. And what they have done here is tried to, if you like, step into Labor territory. And generally they've done that. And this is the one exception. And the one exception has been to pick on a scapegoat, and who could be better scapegoat than somebody who's a drug user as well as a welfare recipient. And that's really the sad part.
Mm. What effect do you think drug testing on welfare recipients would have on the individuals involved?
Well, let me put it in a positive way. What if this money that they're spending on this went into treatment, and we don't have enough treatment places, we're about 300,000 places short on treatment, we would have said, wow, well, that's a really interesting and appropriate way for us to go. But what will happen is, yes, we'll drug test people, and then we won't be able to get them into treatment. So I just don't think they have thought this through. I think it's a flush of blood to the head. And it also is very interesting because the argument is, well, what we want to do is make sure that we're drug testing people who are effectively who are using government money. Maybe what we should be doing is alcohol and drug testing those people who sit in Parliament House who use drug money. Who use government money. Are they? How do they go in terms of their drug testing, especially if you would look at alcohol? Mm. Maybe what we should be doing is going, the public service, I actually don't recommend any of those, but I think they are just as ridiculous as this proposal.
So you don't think that if they were tested, I'm talking about both, you know, public servants, that, as you know, we're talking about there, Jackie Lambie suggested that earlier in the week, and then also welfare recipients, if these people were tested, and then if they did fail these drug tests, wouldn't that be the first step into getting them into treatment?
Well, if that's what the goal was, then we'd go, well, there might be something appropriate, but why would you pick on this particular group of people who are already seriously disadvantaged? What we should be doing is going and saying, who is it that is who needs treatment, who looks at treatment? And remember that the evidence shows that forcing people onto treatment has a very, very poor success rate. Might have a temporary success, but over a longer period, the evidence is illustrating that it has very, very little success. So I think that what we've got here is a policy that's more a rush of blood to the head than one that's been thought out, that's been carefully assessed, and that will actually have a serious impact.
Mm. Do you think drug addiction should be considered a disability in some cases?
Oh, no. I think that drug addiction and misuse of drugs should be dealt with within the alcohol and drug sector and with treatment. So according to a review of alcohol and other drug treatments in Australia in New Horizons, there were 200,000 people, around 200,000 people who are currently receiving alcohol and drug treatment, and the estimation is somewhere between another 200,000 and 500,000 seeking treatment and are unable to access it. So it's not a case of people who are going, no, I'm still happy, I'm using drugs, I don't need treatment. These are people who are seeking treatment and aren't able to access it.
Why aren't they able to access the treatment?
Because there's not enough treatment.
But why isn't there enough treatment?
Because the government doesn't put enough money into it.
Okay, so if we were to let's make Michael Moore the Prime Minister for a day, how would you go about fixing it?
Well, actually, probably Treasurer. So the first thing is to say, all right, who's doing the alcohol and drug treatment systems? How can you expand? Because you can't just do this overnight, mm-hmm. but what you can do is make the commitment of an injection of money to be able to run the treatment, but you also have to train the people who are able to run successful treatments and make sure they're being done according to proven systems, you know, mm-hmm. in peer-reviewed literature. We do have lots of systems, and there are different systems that suit different people, and so they range from the Salvation Army style to some that are religious to some who are completely secular, those that are sometimes done as a live-in system and those who are done supporting people in other ways. So there's quite a range of treatment. It also depends how seriously somebody has an addiction. And of course, the other element that I would be looking for is early intervention, because I think that as Prime Minister, and thank you for the promotion,
no problem.
That I would be going, early intervention's good. But the other lesson as Prime Minister that I would learn is from Portugal. And I would say
what have they done there?
And so what they've done is they've pulled large sums of their money out of policing, and they've still allowed the police to go for the big drug traffickers, and they keep that section of policing, but they've gone completely for all drugs to be decriminalised. And, you know, the really amazing... And so the investment went into treatment. Mm. And the amazing part is the drug usage has dropped significantly over 10 years.
Right.
So it's not only that we get people into treatment, but actually less people are using as well. And there's a reason behind that. The people who are using drugs can pay for it by getting somebody else to use drugs as well. And so you have it like a pyramid system that builds.
Right. And how does that sort of extrapolate out?
So if you're a drug user, you're enjoying using your drug, but you're not yet addicted, but it's expensive. So what you do is you just find two or three other people to sell to it.
Right.
And then the same thing happens with those two or three other people, or two out of three, if you like.
Mm-hmm.
And so the system builds in a pyramid. And so when we talk about the drug dealer, actually the vast majority of cases, the drug dealer is somebody who's known, who's a friend, who you get on with, and who is enjoying the drug use. And normally this happens at a time prior to a serious addiction, but a time when people are having trouble affording the drugs.
Mm. All very interesting stuff. And so treatment probably the better way to go than punishment.
I think if we really want to seriously deal with this issue, then we should be dealing with treatment, and we certainly shouldn't be looking at our already marginalised group to marginalise them even further. I think the failure here is for that ability for somebody to put themselves in somebody else's shoes.
Mm.
And I think one of the really interesting people to listen to in the Parliament now, and who's really gaining in status, is Jackie Lambie, who has been in these shoes.
Mm. Mm.
And a couple of her really outstanding speeches have been about what it's like to be on welfare when her colleagues around her are picking on, marginalising people on welfare.
Thank you to 2SER's Adrian Walton and Michael Moore, Chief Executive Officer of the Public Health Association of Australia. For bringing us that story. You're on 2SER, 107.3. Our next story, we look at online scammers and the ruses that they are using to target older people. It will all be laid bare at a series of Law Week workshops delivered by Legal Aid New South Wales at libraries across the state. From May 15th to May 19th, Legal Aid New South Wales lawyers will be on hand at more than 30 New South Wales libraries. We speak with Lauren Finestone from Legal Aid New South Wales.
That's right. It's actually National Law Week, so an annual event that helps shine a light on the law and the legal system in Australia. And, yeah, we'll have legal aid lawyers in more than 30 libraries around the state doing talks on two legal topics in libraries, and it's a partnership with the State Library of New South Wales.
Are the elderly particularly vulnerable to scammers?
Look, people over 65 are more likely to be victims of online fraudsters than other age groups, and I think that's because older people can be more vulnerable to scams because the scammers think that they have more access to money or see them as less cyber savvy. You know, it's not just older people or even people who are a bit gullible who are vulnerable. I mean, online fraudsters are manipulative and they prey on our good nature, but certainly people over 65 are who we are targeting with these presentations. That's right.
3 years ago, 74-year-old Jeanette Peterson fell victim to one such phone and internet scam.
I was actually on the computer and I got a phone call saying, "This is Optus here. I hear you're having a problem, you know, your reception is really slow." And I said, "Yes, it is." So they offered to help. I think they actually had an Australian accent. I allowed them to log onto my computer because you can see the keys moving and things, and we chatted for ages, maybe even an hour. And they asked me if I wanted any software to fix it up? And I said yes, and gave them my credit card details, etc. And then later on, my daughter Maggie came home and she said, Mum, that's a scam. And I said, how would you know? She said, of course it is. They'd never ring you. So I've had to change all my passwords, and it's a nightmare because I still can't remember them.
The most common scam probably are investment scams, but closely followed by dating and romance scams. So that's where scammers create fake profiles on legitimate dating websites and social media such as Facebook, and then they are very quick to move their victims from those websites and social media to email, online chat or phone communication. But I guess what we're seeing is an increasing number of scams evolving from one type of scam to another, and people are getting into all sorts of trouble, including with the law. I can give you some examples of those, but the reason we've chosen this topic is because we see these sorts of issues a lot in our work at Legal Aid. Using the internet is such a normal everyday experience, but many people don't realise how easily they can get into trouble with the law or experience a legal problem.
How often are the victims of scams able to get justice, get their money back?
Yeah, so that's a really good point. With online scams, once you've lost your money, it's pretty much impossible to get it back. So the reason we're doing these talks during Law Week is if we let people know how to recognise the warning signs and how to protect themselves, then they can prevent problems from happening in the first place. Like I said, some scams go further than just ripping people off financially. Scam victims can wind up in illegal activities, themselves, like being involved in, say, drug trafficking. This is a really good example of what we call a sort of a changing or an evolving scam. So that was a client that Legal Aid represented who was contacted by someone claiming to be a businessman in Nigeria. And he was invited to invest in an oil business. He was told he could expect to double his money in 2 years. Our client did invest money, a significant amount of money, over the course of a year, and then the scammer disappeared. And then what happened was that the client was contacted by someone claiming to be an official to the president of Nigeria, and he was told that he had been identified as a scam victim and that the Nigerian government would compensate him. So there's two types of scams there already. With these compensation scams, there's always a catch where the scammers say you have to pay fees over a period of time to get the money released. And so what this gentleman did was he was told that he needed to travel to the Philippines to sign documents before he could collect his money. And then when he got there, he was asked to take a suitcase back to Australia. And that suitcase contained clothes, but it also contained a large quantity of heroin in the soles of the shoes. And the case that you referred to was what we call a competition scam. So we represented an elderly man who received an email. He was just online one day. He received an email telling him that he'd won an all-expenses-paid overseas trip. And he had happened to be researching holidays at the time, so it seemed completely believable to him. And he responded to the email. He was sent flight and accommodation bookings. And then when he got to his destination, he was even given luggage and invited to extend his holiday with a trip to Australia. And again, hidden in the lining of his brand new suitcase was a large quantity of cocaine.
How do listeners find out more about these workshops and how to get to them?
Yeah, okay. So the best way to do that, because they're in, we're giving talks around the state, to find out where the closest talk would be is to go onto our website, which is www.legalaid.nsw.gov.au. Search for Law Week 2017 and you'll find our workshops calendar, and that will have details of all the participating libraries. And then you can also call your local library to find out more and to book a place.
Thank you again to Lauren Feinstone from Legal Aid New South Wales and Jeanette Peterson for speaking to us. Don't go anywhere, because up next we hear about the budget's effect on the Aboriginal community. Here on Razor's Edge on 2SER 107.3.
Sydney Film Festival is now on sale. There's over 350 screenings of 288 films from 62 countries over 12 days in 10 venues. From the magnificent State Theatre in the city to the Ritz Cinema in Randwick, there's bound to be a film and a venue just right for you. It all happens from June 7 to 18. You can buy your flexi passes or single tickets right now at sff.org.au. Sydney Film Festival, proudly sponsoring 2SER 107.3.
And you're back on Razor's Edge with me, Jesse Begley. We go to our final story of the evening about Aboriginal affairs. In February, Malcolm Turnbull delivered the 9th annual Closing the Gap report, revealing 6 of the 7 recommendations implemented a decade ago to improve outcomes in health, education and employment, and they are not on track. During the Treasurer Scott Morrison's speech to Parliament, he said the budget sets out a credible and affordable plan based on the principle of fairness, security and opportunity. But just what opportunities are outlined for Indigenous Australians? Kyle Dowling spoke with Federal Minister of Aboriginal Affairs, Senator Nigel Scullion, who said the 2017 to 2018 budget is a remarkable injection into Aboriginal affairs. And we'll be to see through this song from our feature album, Underground Lovers, Unbearable.
We just like buying. We just like time on the phone. Like feeling faces like time that won't fade away. You're my ticket to ride. You're my ticket in time and the score. Likes feeling. She likes her name on the door. Do, 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 do.
For that, we'll be hearing from that story next week about the injection, about the changes to Aboriginal affairs in Australia. Anyway, that's us for this week from Razor's Edge. A big thanks to our Razor's Edge producers for getting us these intriguing stories: Ellie Madridge, Bronte Walker, Lena Han, and Hyo Jin Shim. That's the end of our program. Razor's Edge at 2SER's Sydney Focus Current Affairs program. Don't worry, though, we'll be back at our usual time at 7.30 on Thursdays, same day, same time with different stories. If you'd like to hear any stories from tonight's program again, or indeed any story we've played, you can head over to our website. Don't go anywhere, though, because Static is up next with 2 hours of awesome new music for you.
We do it.
I've been stopped on the street and spat on.
How many pages do I have to do and how much have I...